Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
It is time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT.
Thank you, MOTAT.
And our first story, I saw this earlier this week. It's just pretty devastating, the effects of it.
Yep.
Pharmac has pulled funding for the drugs that support people with epilepsy.
Where do we start on this one? Because this is a tricky one, really, because there's certainly two sides to this. So first up, what happens when you develop a drug? I guess we need to talk about that.
Okay.
And so as soon as I start talking about this, you'll get texts saying Big Pharma.
Right.
Guaranteed. Okay. Now, so if you develop a drug, you've got to go through an inordinate series of processes to get it approved. Okay. Mm-hmm. And very, very few drugs end up getting approved, which is why drugs cost so much.
Yep.
Okay. Plain and simple. I'm not taking sides on this. That's just the way that it is. And so in response to that, you then are allowed to patent those drugs, and you get, certainly in the US anyway, you get 20-year patent on that drug. And that means that you can then manufacture it, sell it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and hopefully recoup all of those investments that you made in developing said drug, which are going to be huge.
Is 20 years short in the scheme of things?
No, 20 years is long, actually. I always thought it was about 7, but having a look at it, it's certainly 20 since 1995, I think.
Yep.
Okay. Now, at the end of that 20-year period, then others are allowed to make, manufacture, and sell that same drug.
Mm-hmm.
And these are what generics are, okay? So, The thing that's made the news this week about Pharmac is that they are switching funding from a brand name, a so-called brand name anti-epilepsy drug, to a generic.
I see, okay.
And now, this is going to save Pharmac over the next 5 years, it's going to save them $30 million. Okay. Now, a generic should be the same as the brand name drug.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole point of a generic, okay? So I quote from, I think it was a document put out by MedSafe, that a generic must have the same dosage, form, strength, route of administration, and conditions of use as the innovator product, which is the original brand name drug. The applicant must show that a generic product delivers the same amount of its active ingredient in the same amount of time as its trade name counterpart.
Yep.
Okay. And that was my understanding of generics, is they had to be identical.
Yeah.
But seemingly they don't.
Okay, first of all, when you say they have to be identical, this requires the innovator to put out their information, once their patent is over, they have to release, they're forced to release? Or?
Well, that should be actually in the patent. They have to describe what their invention is in the patent. So it is there,
or it certainly should be accessed.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Now, second question, yes. What do you mean it? They're not required to be exactly the same.
Well, it did say there that they must have the same dosage, form, blah, 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 and the same amount of its active ingredient in the same amount of time, okay? So the active ingredient has to be the same. Now, that's an absolute no-brainer because that's your drug molecule.
Yep.
Now, when you take a pill, it's not all your actual drug molecule. There are other things in that pill, okay?
For example, Panadol, you'll be taking not just paracetamol you'll be taking.
Okay, so number one, to get pills to stick together, you've got to have some special sort of binding compound in there, okay? It may be that you've got to hold the pills at a certain pH, something like that. So you're going to have buffers maybe in there, okay? So these additives, they're called excipients, okay? And they are present in all drugs, basically. Anything that you've got to turn into a pill, you're going to have to do it with the aid of these things. So what seems to happen is that in some cases the excipients can be different, okay? The active compound's got to be the same, but the excipients can be different. And then what you may find is that some people have a bad reaction to the excipients, which you would hope that wouldn't be the case, because these should just be very, very simple, bloody
basic
compounds.
Basic general things that everybody uses.
Exactly. But seemingly it's not. Now, again, anybody who's followed this one in the news will have read some quite awful stories of patients who had been seizure-free for many, many years, who then went on the generic and within a week or two were suffering seizures or symptoms of seizures. And You know, that's seemingly the only difference in their life is that they went from the brand name drug to the generic.
Yeah.
And this isn't good.
No.
This really, really isn't good. Now, as I said, my understanding of a generic, ideally it should be identical in all respects. And there's no argument to say that you can't do that. I mean, surely if the drug companies are required to say exactly what is in their material and how it's made, then a generic manufacturer can surely come along and replicate that exactly. And it seems that that's not necessarily the case. Now, Pharmac, I'm a big fan of. I think they do wonderful things. I think that they, in negotiating basically with drug companies, I think they do the country a great service. And God knows I would not want to be in charge of Pharmac, because there's no way in God's green earth that you're going to please everybody. And you literally, literally have people's lives in your hand there, don't you?
Yeah, everybody's heckles get up when you mention pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, of course. And you know, there are really tragic bloody stories out there that people need this medication and Pharmac doesn't fund it. But, you know, they can't win. Pharmac
can't
win.
A hard place.
Yes.
But, okay, yeah. So this is, they've switched the drug because it's cheaper, essentially.
Yes.
It saves them a significant amount of money.
Yep.
If this is the case, though, and the generic is obviously having quite a significant impact on people's lives.
Seemingly, yes. Yep.
Surely there would be a switchback or some sort of negotiation around. Because the issue seems, like you say, to be the excipients.
Well, that has to be
the
issue.
Where is the law that says that the excipients should be the same?
Well, again, the way that the pill is prepared can make a hell of a difference as to how it's actually absorbed and the rate that it's absorbed in the body, okay? And that may be sort of a proprietary secret, how they actually press the pills and stuff like that. You've also got the problem of things called polymorphs, which are, you might have the same compound, but it can exist in different solid forms. And those different solid forms can have different solubilities. And so they might not get into your bloodstream as quickly as each other, okay? So there are all of these things that need to be looked at. And hell, you know, if I was Minister of Health or whatever, which I never will be, but I would surely insist that generics have to be identical. Mm. That's what surprised me looking into this, that they apparently are not, and they don't have to be. And it apparently, in looking at the regulations in the States, you can have a wiggle room of around about 20%, which seems to me ridiculous. I think we're tighter here.
Yeah.
But again, I don't absolutely know for sure. But I think this in here is a story for a really, really good investigative journalist to go and find the exact details of the whole generic industry. Okay. Mm. And, you know, we want to make sure that if we're relying on generics, or certainly Pharmac is relying on generics to lower our drug bill, we need to make absolutely sure that they are, you know, 1,000% safe.
Mm.
You know, so
really,
really interesting story. And I think there's probably going to be a lot more to come on that.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on to chemistry or electrochemistry.
Oof,
and carbon.
There we go.
Footprint, carbon footprint. Cement. Let's just talk about concrete.
Okay, and you might think, well, concrete, that's fairly benign stuff, and we do kind of rely on it because there's buttloads of it around. And in fact, humanity makes 4 billion tons of cement annually. And surprisingly, that's the most produced product in the world, which, I was quite surprised to find out. So it's important, but it also contributes around about 8% of the world's carbon emissions, so making cement. And the reason for this is that one of the ingredients in cement is limestone.
Mm-hmm.
Limestone is calcium carbonate, CaCO3. Now, the chemical formula of carbon dioxide is CO2. So you can take CaCO3 and take CO2 out of that, and you end up with CaO, which is calcium oxide. And that is an important process in the whole cement manufacturing thing.
Uh-huh.
You basically take limestone, throw it in with some all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Excipients.
And you mix them up at high temperature. So you stick them in a kiln, basically, and you've got to heat them up around about 1,500 degrees there or thereabouts. And that drives off the CO2 from the carbonate. Mm-hmm. And the CO2 disappears, obviously, into the atmosphere because you're working in big kilns and everything. It's difficult to recover all of your exhaust gases, your flue gases from that. And so people are starting to look for another way of doing this first step where you've got to turn your calcium carbonate into calcium oxide or calcium hydroxide, same thing, essentially.
Okay.
So a bunch of chemists at MIT, the Massachusetts, not the Manukau, Institute of Technology.
Yes. Easily mixed up.
So they have developed a way of using electricity to carry this process out of turning calcium carbonate into calcium hydroxide. Now, that process still involves the loss of CO2. But now, because you're doing this using electrochemistry, you can now do this at room temperature, this first process, number one. So that's going to save you a lot of energy.
Wow. No fires.
No. Indeed, no fires. No, yeah, no fossil fuel.
Creation in that step.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they can take the CO2 that is given out in this process, and they can easily then use that as a feedstock for organic molecules because it's easy basically to get. It's not like you're operating in a kiln at 1500 degrees and trying to recover the CO2. You're working at room temperature. You can easily recover the CO2. And another thing is that the other byproducts of this particular reaction are hydrogen and oxygen, and the beauty then is that you can take hydrogen and oxygen and you can take your calcium hydroxide that you have generated and you can use that in the next step, which has to operate at 1500 degrees, but you can use the hydrogen oxygen to power that.
Whoa,
so
whoa,
again,
whoa.
You're not using fossil fuels to power that and again creating more CO2.
So when does that start?
When does that start? Well, it has started now. It's obviously, again, on a small scale, as a lot of these things are, and possibly prematurely reported, maybe, as again a lot of these things are, because a lot of things show a lot of promise in the laboratory, but when it comes to actually scaled up processes on the large scale, they might not work. This is in the former category, so this has just been shown in the laboratory, and now they need to show that they can scale this up and
test it in real life.
Yeah, and hopefully take out 8% of our carbon emissions, which can only be a good thing.
Yeah.
So
that's a fairly big amount for a production of one thing.
Of course, it's going to be electrically based, so you obviously don't want fossil fuel derived electricity here. So, you know, anything. And this is the big thing with electricity. Everybody thinks that electricity is going to sort of save the world, which it may well do, which would be great. You know, electric cars and all that. Where does the electricity come from? Now, in New Zealand.
Where did lithium batteries come from?
And, you know, in New Zealand, we're blessed through having a lot of renewable energy generation, so dams and everything like that. Other parts of the world are not so lucky. Mm. So, you know, the sooner we all utilize solar, the better. Because, you know, that's going to be the way that humanity will be saved. Solar power, folks. You heard it here
first. Alan Blackman. actually, somebody just texted in saying daylight saving was invented in World War I to try and save heating fuel. The idea being if you get people to bed earlier in the winter, they won't use as much fuel.
I think that could be right. Yes, I think I've, yep.
I could believe that. Okay.
Apparently they...
I'm getting sold on that. You know,
well, they don't have it in Queensland. They have it everywhere else in Australia, but they don't have it in Queensland. Apparently one of the reasons was that it would fade the curtains in the summer.
Okay.
Apparently. Wow. All that extra sunlight.
we'll quickly do our last two stories.
Yes.
So opposing research around meat consumption, to eat meat or not to eat meat?
Well, apparently it's to eat meat now because it's okay for you. So researchers in Canada at Dalhousie and McMaster Universities, they have done a big meta-analysis of a whole lot of previously carried out studies looking at whether there's any link between eating red meat and things like diabetes and cancer and all of these nasty sorts of things, cardiovascular disease. And they found there's not. So their recommendation, keep eating that red meat, folks. It's not bad for you.
But your point about this story.
Right. So immediately this comes out, then our friends at Harvard, good old Harvard, or however you pronounce it, came out with a counter argument, and they said, and I quote, so the recommendation runs contradictory to the large body of evidence indicating higher consumption of red meat is associated with higher risk of type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, certain cancers, and death.
So they're very opposing.
Well, they couldn't
in their
be
conclusion.
More different, could they?
Yeah.
Okay. So who do you believe?
Yeah. Who do we believe, Alan?
I have no answer for that. Okay. Any science that involves humans is going to have this problem. Okay. Especially things like nutrition. Okay. Because you can't do the control experiment. You can't.
Because everybody's different.
Yeah. Because everybody is different. And you can't just have, you know, one person eating nothing but red meat and the other person, you know, eating nothing but vegetables.
Yeah.
It doesn't work like that. And you can't do it like that. And people are different. And you're always going to get these conflicting results. Shit, one day coffee's good for you, the next day it's bad for you. You know, wine, red wine, brilliant for you. Now, what was it the other day? I think that one glass of wine
reduces,
keeps away dementia or whatever, but it's better than zero glasses or two glasses, you know. I mean,
what
come on.
Yeah. Yep.
So, I don't know who to believe on this one. I really don't. But I do like my meat, I've got to say.
But what's okay? But in the terms of like the scheme of things, then how do we find things out when it comes to humans?
You're absolutely right, and that's a bloody good question. And if anybody's got an answer to that, you know, I don't know. Possibly the only way that we've got is long-term observations, basically, and you've sort of got to base it on that, really. But that's silly because you want the answer now, don't you? You don't want the answer in 50 years' time. No. You want it now. Mm. And it really is difficult. So if there's any sort of purveyors of this sorts of science listening, you know, I'd be very, very interested to hear
more about
how
that.
You actually discern what is a good study from what isn't a good study.
Yeah. Good question. And our final piece.
Yep.
Something I guess we could have known years in advance. This was what I found interesting.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So a few weeks ago, I think we talked briefly about measles,
mm-hmm.
and somebody texted in and said it's not an epidemic. And I think at that moment there were 900 cases, I think, in the country. So as of like last week or today or whatever, 1,541 cases mm-hmm. in New Zealand. That's more cases of measles than there have been this year in the States and in the UK, I believe. I'd call that an epidemic,
mm-hmm.
okay? The problem being that apparently, we're running out of vaccine, so we weren't prepared for this. So there are limited stores of vaccines around the country, and people are not getting vaccinated. And again, according to the story, there's a quote like something, there is incomplete data or shonky data or something for people aged 20 to 29. Now, people aged 20 to 29 are the largest cohort of people suffering from the measles at the moment. So there's about 500 or so cases in the country, people aged 20 to 29. Hate to say it, but when I was a kid, we had Plunket. I don't know whether Plunket still exists or not.
I believe it does.
And everybody had a Plunket book.
Remember? I don't know if babies actually now have Plunket books.
Well, shit, we've got a thing called the internet, you know, and we've got computers, and this can easily be, you know, done using computers. We should know absolutely down to the last human being in this country how many people have been immunised against measles.
I see
we
what
should.
You mean, recording the data in the sense of whether they have.
It's way easier to do it these days than it was when I was a kid. You know, having to remember your Plunket book when you went down to the doctor or whatever. Mm. This is crazy, folks. This is absolutely crazy. And it comes back to that Andrew Wakefield about who I do not have any good words, so I won't say the bad ones that I'm thinking right now. But look, his so-called study is totally discredited. There is no link between autism and measles, mumps and rubella vaccine. There's just not.
I also found interesting the article that we're talking about is that there was this information was available, or that has been, right? And even a couple of years ago, there were warnings about the possibility of an epidemic.
Yep. Yep.
And there were suggestions by scientists that a campaign around this information in terms of actually encouraging people to be vaccinated should have happened.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And it's the horse is kind of bolted now, but I guess it's never too late to just say, get your kids immunised. And if you haven't been immunised, get immunised. And I come from one of the ages, I guess, where I actually had measles when I was a kid. That was a rite of passage. All your kids went through that. And then 1969, they bought an immunisation. So it's a dangerous, it's a potentially dangerous disease.
All right. Thank you so much, Alan. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Will do, Lillian.
Let us
thank
know when you.
You
find out about the human studies.
Indeed. Okay.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
All sus for